My name is Christine from Alt92.3, and we're in the radio.com theater right now with Anais Mitchell, the creative mind behind Hadestown, which is on Broadway now. So nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it's great timing to have you here because Hadestown and you just nominated for a Grammy.
Yeah. Yeah, we're totally thrilled. It's really exciting.
So that just happened yesterday. It is for Best Musical Theater Album for the original Broadway cast recording. Where were you when you found out?
I think that I was awakened with the news, you know. I was sort of like rolled out of bed a little late. I know we both have small kids, and so usually like I'm up, you know, before anyone. But I got to sleep in, and when I woke up, my phone was blown up with the text and stuff. Yeah, it's totally thrilling. And I'm, you know, I come from the music world. Most of my life, I've just been a songwriter making records. And so the Grammys means a lot to me. Like, I watched it as a kid, and I always kind of wanted to be part of it. So it's really exciting.
And Hadestown itself, and you, no stranger to awards at this point, a Tony Award for Best Musical.
Yay.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. And then one for you as well for original score, correct?
That's right.
So how has that journey been over just this past year of getting the accolades for something that, as we'll talk about in a bit, has been a long journey?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, I've been working on this show for like a third of my life. And so it was really, and I didn't know where it was heading. You know, it was exciting enough and inspiring enough that I wanted to keep going. And I've had some amazing collaborators from early on, but especially with this team that brought the show to Broadway. And so to see so many people recognized at the Tonys was, I have to say, in the moment of the awards happening, I was like a deer in the headlights. Like, I didn't, couldn't believe, it was very surreal. I couldn't believe that it was happening. And then later, with a little space, I started to just feel so grateful and satisfied because, not for the award itself, but for the indication that the piece was like moving a lot of people. And I'm just so glad that this piece that's been in the works for so long and came out of a kind of the wild woods of Vermont where I used to live, is reaching people at a really a bigger level.
So as you mentioned, a third of your life, this has been a creative work, which sort of parallels the musical. There's a long, long road in all of our journeys. But yeah. Can you go back to the very beginning days of Hadestown and how we got to this moment here on Broadway?
Yeah. So I was right out of college and just starting to try to have a songwriter career. I remember I was driving from one gig to another. I would play like for tips, you know, anyone that would give me a gig, I would take the gig. And I was driving between towns, and some lyrics came into my head that didn't end up in the first version of the show, but they came with the melody of Wait For Me, which is one of our big songs.
I'll cry just thinking about it. Oh. So it's beautiful. It really is.
Oh, thank you. And the lyrics went, wait for me, I'm coming in my garters and pearls. With what melody did you barter me from the wicked underworld? And that was those lines never appeared in the show in any form, but they kind of pointed the way toward the story. And the first version of Hadestown happened as a DIY community theater project in Vermont, where I used to live. It was all like friends that were the creative team and the cast and the band, just singers from different bands around Vermont. And we put it together on like a shoestring, and we rolled around in a school bus that was painted silver. And we played like town halls and small like opera houses and things like that. And then a few years later, I made an album of the music that had some great guest singers on it. It had like Justin Vernon from Bon Iver and Ani DeFranco, who I was working with her record label at the time, and Greg Brown. And we put that record out and then toured the show as like a concert for a couple of years. So it was just me and a band, and then different guest singers in different regions, and they would all learn the stuff, you know, in a couple of days, and then we would perform it. And I always wanted to put the show back in the theater and work on it more and kind of develop it into a full length musical. At that time, it was about an hour long. But I didn't quite know how or who to partner with. Eventually I found Rachel Chavkin, who was at the time working on The Great Comet Show, Dave Malloy's Great Comet. And our two lead producers, Dale Franzen and Mara Isaacs. And we started to work on the show in the kind of New York way with the workshops and the equity scene. And it was another 3 years before we did the show off Broadway. Then we went to Edmonton. And then we went to London, and then we finally arrived on Broadway. That was maybe more than you bargained for of the story, but...
No, but it is. It's a massive undertaking, and the making of a Broadway musical itself is truly a team effort. And you've talked about some of the collaborators that you were able to work with. I mean, Justin Vernon and Ani, like, those are some really incredible performers. Who are some of the people that you were able to work with specifically on the Broadway version that you've been able to learn from since, as you said, like, it's a completely different process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that the process of assembling the creative team took place over a number of years. Some of my collaborators have been with me since the beginning. Michael Chorney, one of our two orchestrators, was arranging the songs for his band even back in Vermont in 2006. And then Todd Sikafoos, who produced the studio record with those guest singers on it, he's the other arranger orchestrator of the music. And their sound is such a huge part of this music. You know, it's as you've seen the show, it's a kind of New Orleans, like, sometimes sounds like a big band, sometimes like a street party.
It's got some funk to it for sure.
Yeah. And then I was working with Rachel, also, a dramaturg named Ken Chernelia was like really important. Ken and Rachel and I, me coming to the theater from the music world, I had a lot to learn in terms of how to make the songs tell a story. So it was really great to work with both of those guys on the dramaturgy. And then, David Newman, our choreographer, Rachel Hauk, our set designer, and Michael Crass, our costume designer, Bradley King, our lighting designer. All of those guys have been with us since New York Theater Workshop off Broadway. And there was time for us to make a lot of mistakes along the way. You know, we made a lot of changes. We kept kind of tweaking things and turning the lens and sometimes going down a wrong road and having to pull back. And so it does feel like the arrival on Broadway was a sort of the whole community, the whole village kind of rolled up on one train car.
Well, and that's truly a journey, right? There's not a beginning and an end, and that's a straight line. It always takes loops. It always takes detours. And this particular story, even if you don't know the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, we hear from the very beginning that it's a sad song. It's a tragedy. Maybe it'll turn out differently this time, but that's the origin story. So what do you think brings us as human beings back to sad songs and tragedies to experience them, even when we do know how they're going to turn out?
Yeah, that's a really good question, you know? And it's not like I didn't ask myself at certain times, like, should it really have this sad ending? Is this ever going to, you know, can you put this story on Broadway? But that's what the myth is. And I think there's something about it that brings us back again and again, especially because in the Orpheus story, you know, Orpheus, this beautiful, most beautiful musician in the world, he goes to the underworld to try to get his bride Eurydice back from Hades. And you're all set up for like a Hollywood ending. It feels like this triumphant, you know, the hero is going to go down and sing his song. And he does manage to move the heart of Hades, who says, yes, you can have her back, but you have to walk out of the underworld without looking back to make sure that she's following you. And at the last minute, it's his own doubt that undoes him. And we get this tragic ending. And I think there's something about that anatomically strange story that artists have gone back again and again to try to figure out what happened.
because the why? You want to scream why? The whole crowd in the theater was aghast, you know, because that's not what we were expecting. But in between the beginning and that sad moment, there are a lot of really, like you said, transformative moments and moments that I think are viewed very differently now than they maybe were when you were first writing them. I mean, that speaks specifically to 2019, whether it's unpredictable weather and incredible overwhelming heat or the fact that the villain is building a wall. There's, you know, moments that are very current. What are some of the songs and moments in the story that have really transformed for you when you look at it now and you watch it now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a great question. And I have been sort of living with this music and this story for so many years that I've seen those things change. I remember that early on, like, there are songs like Wedding Song, where the lovers kind of talk about these hard times, dark times, and not having enough money to buy the wedding dress or the wedding ring or whatever. And I used to play that song a lot in my songwriter shows, and I sometimes would introduce it as a song from Hadestown, this opera that I was working on, and I'd say it's based on the Orpheus myth, and it's set in a post-apocalyptic depression era. And it was around 2007 or 8 that we had that recession in the States, and people started to, there was a lot of laughing and kind of murmuring when I said that. And those themes of poverty just sort of came, they just jumped out for people. Obviously, Why We Build the Wall, this kind of political anthem that Hades sings to his worker citizens. That song, it was a very strange one for me. Like, I usually labor over my songs for a long time, you know, months, if not years, to try to get it to where it feels like it's right. And that song kind of came out of thin air. Like, it felt like it all came in a rush, and I almost didn't know what it meant. But it became the song that people wanted to hear at my regular shows. And then it really took a turn for the eerie in when did the campaign begin? I can't remember when the...
A million years ago.
The rallies, you know? And it wasn't just the language of who's now the president, but also the call and response nature of those rallies, you know? And that the song is a call and response song where Hades is asking a question, you know, why do we build the wall? And his followers are responding kind of in chorus. So that took on a really new meaning when we did the show in 2016 off Broadway. And then again, it is sort of, I was hoping it would be less relevant now, but it's still on the table.
But here we are.
And there's another one actually that was sort of a surprise for me, which is there's a song called Hey Little Songbird in the first act where, Hades comes above ground and he sort of has set his sights on Eurydice. He's having trouble at home. His marriage is troubled with Persephone, and he sees, you know, a vulnerable young woman that, like, he could maybe make an offer to. And he does. And there's a sort of it's a kind of a seduction, and it's kind of a business transaction, you know? And
there's a contract. There's literally a contract.
Yeah, exactly. And that stuff started to feel really different in the Me Too era. I remember we were doing the show in Edmonton, and suddenly it was less funny. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
that's the power of myth. I mean, these stories, these origin stories, have been around for millennia, and they will outlive us. But you can still keep learning different things from them. And that's the power of art. And when you watch the show, and Hades is obviously this bass voice villain when we first meet him come to take Summer away. But it's the power of art and love, but art that transforms him into something different by the time we see him at the end. So what do you hope that audiences will take away about the power of art after they see Hadestown?
And I just want to say, as an aside, because you're talking about Hades, Patrick Page is just such an extraordinary actor.
He's amazing.
He's amazing. Yeah. And he's been with the show for many years. And I think that the transformation that happens with that character owes a lot to, you know, developing it with him. And he's obviously very good at playing the villain. He's done it many times. You know, he was Scar in The Lion King, and he's played many villains. But he is really in touch with the tender, vulnerable part of that character. And it's moving to see that closer to the end of the show when he sort of gives over to that side of himself. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about the Orpheus story is that Orpheus, especially in this telling of the story, he has a gift to give. And what's ultimately his undoing is that he is asked to do it alone, you know? There's something about the nature of call and response and the nature of singing and hearing someone else sing back to you that gives people hope and helps to move the world forward, you know? And Orpheus, in his last moment, he's all by himself, or he's made to feel very alone. He's on this journey out, you know, on this long journey out of the underworld. He can't see, he can't hear anyone around him. And so his gift is kind of lost. But I think then at the end of the story, you understand that his work has touched, you know, many people. It's touched Hades, it's touched Persephone, it's touched Eurydice, and the workers in the underworld, and that it will, he's lit a flame that will continue. And so I guess I think, you know, the other kind of moral of the story is that it's summed up in that little like coda that gets sung by Persephone at the end, "I raise my cup." It's not, we love Orpheus not because he wins at the end. You know, we love him because he tried. And that's what we have to do. It doesn't matter, you know, what the outcome is going to be, right? We have to try, because that's how to live.
Yeah, I mean, we are all capable of finding and planting our own flowers in a dark place. We all have that capability. It may not look like a beautiful song or playing the lyre, but we all have that gift to give. And faith and doubt come up several times in the musical as well. And I thought about that in terms of the creative process, because there's a lot of doubt in all of us who create. Just like if it's winter, you have to have faith that that tree that's bare will bloom again. And so watching the musical, I was really taken by that. And in a lot of ways, it is about how in the darkness we can find our own light. And it's the process that takes us through and gives us the faith that it'll be light again.
Uh-huh. That's beautiful. I love that. And yeah, and Orpheus, you know, throughout the course of Hadestown, he's working on this one song. He's working on this song called The Epic. And there's and it contains a melody in it that he believes, you know, could bring the springtime back again. He's, you know, he says that many times. And I actually was thinking about, I know that you have studied the kind of different versions of this myth, and
there's been a lot of tellings. You know, there's a lot to unpack in it. Yeah,
yeah. And I haven't gone too deep on this stuff, but I did. You know, at some point, I read the Ovid and the what's the other one? The Aeneid.
Aeneid. Yeah. Yeah.
And what I found really interesting was that in those retellings, Orpheus, when he confronts Hades, you know, he doesn't really, it's not like he's a revolutionary confronting this leader. He approaches Hades by saying, I know how you feel about your wife. Like that's, you know, that's in the Ovid and the Aeneid that he says, like, if you, you know, I know how you feel about Persephone. Imagine this is how I feel about Eurydice, and please give her back to me. Please let her go. And the fact that he offers the king a chance to get back in touch with who he is as a man, right? That's part of the job of the artist.
Well, that's empathy. That's something that I think gets lost a lot in a modern world that moves really, really fast. That when we remember to stop and connect with other people and maybe not always feel their pain, because that can be overwhelming, but simply to understand what it's like to be in someone else's shoes or be able to see things from the other side of the coin. When you're moving so fast, and the world does, I mean, much faster than it did when those myths and stories were first written. But that's kind of what art gives us a chance to do, I think, right? To pause and look at things from a different perspective.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, at its best, yes, I think that's true. And that feels like validating, because it does take time. I think it does take a lot of time to make a lasting piece of work. And, I think there is a lot of pressure on artists these days to move really quickly and to create content, you know.
Sure, it's like, the streaming world, you know. Yeah. It's a consumption-based world.
Right.
But artists are still making albums and authors are still writing books.
Yes.
And Broadway still exists as a place where people go and gather to collectively experience something that makes us laugh and makes us cry or makes us pause. And that's still really, really powerful. No matter how connected we can be through our devices, we still have to do that every once in a while.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the great things about going to the theater is you actually do have to turn your phone off. Like, you really
literally
have to turn it off.
They come and check.
Yeah, yeah. That's not even the case at like a music show anymore. You know, there's a lot of phones out there.
Yeah. So this is such a special moment in the journey of Hadestown, the day after the Grammy nomination and having been on Broadway and receiving these great reviews. So there's a lot of things in the works and there's a lot of things that have just been announced. What is next on the Hadestown journey for you and for the musical?
Mm-hmm. So we're about to have our 250th show.
Woo-hoo!
Tomorrow.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And, you know, the show continues. We're planning a tour, which begins next fall. And that's going to be, I don't know if those dates exist yet, but it's a multi-city, you know, tour. I'm working on a book. This is related to Hadestown. It's that's coming out in the spring. It's basically it's a book of lyrics. It's got all the lyrics that are in the Broadway show, and then also a lot of alternate lyrics from previous versions of the show, which I hope will be really interesting to both people that want to know more about the show, but also like writers who are interested in the process.
Oh, sure, because it, like we were talking about earlier, it's never a linear process. It's, you know, starts and stops and having to stop and go, oh no, that doesn't work. And being able to acknowledge that is sometimes the way through to the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, being able to see, to pull behind the curtain, that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's been very kind of therapeutic for me to work on it because, as I said, it's been such a lot of my life, and to look backward and see like what happened over the last however many years. And also, you know, the show has been, its development has been very public because I made that studio record back, it came out in 2010. And then there's also an off-Broadway version of there's a live recording from our off-Broadway show. And now there's this, you know, comprehensive Broadway cast recording, which has everything in it. And
this cast truly is amazing.
They're so amazing.
They're so good.
Yeah. I stand in complete awe of them. Like the fact that they are making magic like that every single night for so long.
Yeah.
Like, and staying in it.
And having seen it and having heard, because I have streamed the recording a time or two after seeing it. But, you know, when you hear Eva as Eurydice for the first time and that voice comes out of this little tiny creature and you're like, oh my goodness, you just know you're in for something really special and really powerful.
Totally. She's full of surprises.
And then you personally outside of Hadestown, are there some musical things that are in the works for you outside? I know you have an awful lot going on with the musical, but there's some other stuff going on for you creatively as well, right?
Yeah, you know, the kind of one little pan that I have kept in the fire the last year or two while I was working on the Broadway show is this new traditional folk band. It's called Bonnie Light Horsemen, and it's myself and this guy, Eric Johnson from the Fruit Bats, and then this guitarist and producer, Josh Kaufman, who lives in New York. And we made an album which is coming out in January, and so we'll be touring around with that music, and we're really excited about it.
You have a lot going on.
Yeah.
It's nice. For a creative person, it's got to be good to have a lot of different outlets that you can put all of your creative energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one has felt really, really good because there's a lot of us putting our creative energy into it and kind of arranging things and in some cases co-writing. But the core of the lyrics comes from really old, old traditional music, mostly from across the pond, England, Scotland, Ireland. Yeah. And it's so nice to not feel like these things are being created from scratch, you know, and you sort of can rest in the source material.
Well, this has been an absolutely wonderful chat. I feel like I need to go journal. I need to go write. I need to go produce because that's what good art does. It makes you want to go make more art.
Yay.
Thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon. We really appreciate it. And good luck with everything. And good luck with the Grammy nomination.
Thank you so much, Christine. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thank you.